This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll hear about two delegations from Code Pink to Gaza. One got in, one did not.
But their stories are chilling, just chilling. What Israel is doing in Gaza and what it's doing in the occupied territories, all really with the support, sadly, of the United States.
We'll hear about patterns and practices of paid FBI informants infiltrating mosques.
If you go to a mosque, the chances are there'll be an FBI informant or provocateur somewhere inside.
Stay with us. Another delegation from Code Pink Women for Peace and the Coalition of Women for Peace brought humanitarian and emotional support to women and children in Gaza. According to human rights groups and Code Pink, the children of Gaza are suffering physically and psychologically from the continuing siege and the 22-day Israeli military attack last December and January. That attack killed more than 1,440 Palestinians and wounded 5,000. We talk with Code Pink organizer Helen Schiff and legal activist Dennis James about their experiences in Israel, Gaza, and Palestine. Dennis got into Gaza through Egypt and delivered playground equipment. As we'll hear in this interview, the 1.5 million people of Gaza are deprived of basic needs and humanitarian aid that stop from getting into Gaza. Supplies are warehoused and food is left to rot at the hands of the Israeli Defense Force. For the first time, Americans are partnering with Jewish and Arab Israelis to demand that the Israeli government end the siege. Earlier this year, we talked with Code Pink organizers about how the Israelis wear down the fighting spirit of the people of Gaza by forbidding pasta, jam, candy, and any building materials. Desalinization plants were bombed, and children have kidney disease because Israelis have siphoned off the good water and there's too much salt seeping into the wells. So far, Code Pink has coordinated 5 delegations into Gaza in the past 2 months, bringing nearly 200 activists from around the world to witness the destruction of the Palestinian people. Meanwhile, an aid ship heading to Gaza was intercepted by Israeli forces. 21 human rights workers were abducted, including Nobel laureate Myreed Maguire and former U.S. Congresswoman Cynthia McKinney. Dennis James and Helen Schiff join us today. Welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks.
Thank you.
We understand that both of you tried to get into Gaza with varying results in the last month. Can you tell our listeners what happened?
On May 29th, I was with a delegation of Code Pink sponsored 66 persons in 2 buses and a truckload of playground equipment. And we were able to gain entry through the Rafah crossing of the Gaza Strip.
Now, the Rafah crossing is the one that goes, it's in Egypt, right?
That's correct. It's at the southern end of the Gaza Strip.
And that's where the Israelis occasionally, they bomb near there, am I right?
Oh, yes, they certainly do.
Because of the tunnels.
They did, because of the tunnels.
How far are the tunnels from the entrance?
I don't know that. They're all over the place. They estimate maybe there's 1,000 tunnels that go under there at various sizes.
So. Okay.
That's a different matter, but we didn't go through the tunnels.
So you got in through that, and how many days did you stay in Gaza?
We were there from the 29th until the 4th of June.
Okay, so I want to go back to you, but first I want to go back to Helen, because I remember talking to Helen before she left, and I know there were 2 trips, one going through the Rafah entrance in Egypt, and the other an attempt to go through whatever the entrance is called in Israel, but through Israel into Gaza. And I remember Helen saying, I think we have to try this, although I think it's less likely. Neither one was likely, but it's less likely they're going to let us in through Israel. So, Helen, why don't you tell us what happened with your trip?
Yes, we did not, unfortunately, get through the Eretz crossing, which is a crossing from Israel into Gaza. We didn't really expect to, but we thought it was important to make an effort and to get some publicity on that, and we tried to bring in a playground, too. We protested there for 3 days. And we had Patch Adams with us trying to make friends with the border guards and make them laugh, and perhaps that would let us in, but it didn't work. One event we had was really wonderful is that on the Gaza side, 300 people demonstrated at the same time we were on the Israeli side.
That's great.
And we flew kites and we actually talked to them over the phone. And I think, you know, they just love to know, it's important for them to know that people are really supporting them. And so I think it was a wonderful action. And the other interesting thing is that actually Jimmy Carter got in through Eretz just as we were returning home. And he had known about our attempt. And this was a Code Pink delegation, too, that I was on. And it was covered in Newsweek magazine or Time magazine, said, I'd heard there was a group that tried to bring in a playground and crayons and paper and school supplies through the same crossing I went, the Eretz crossing, and Israel would not let that delegation in. Now, how could any of those things have to do with terrorism? And he was very upset about it. So we did get some coverage and some pressure. And, of course, the press in Israel covered us on 3 days of our trying to get in.
Now, Helen, what was the reason they gave you for not letting you in?
They don't have to give a reason.
They just go to the border, you show them papers.
Right, and then we went back to Tel Aviv. The heads of our delegations went back to Tel Aviv. We tried to meet with Israeli officials, and we tried to meet with U.S. Embassy officials, and they just say it's closed. There are very few people, sometimes sick, and this is true for Rafah too, sick people are allowed to go to Israel for treatment. And so there were like three or four people in the 3 days that we saw coming out or going in, some very young children with cancer, a very old woman with her mother who needed some eye surgery. But it's very hard to get permission. Dennis, why don't you tell your story?
Yeah, I'm interested in that because I know you land in Cairo and then you got to figure out how to get to Rafah.
No, but about the people getting sick, you had mentioned.
Yeah, there's a sinister twist to people seeking treatment outside of Gaza. Of course, Palestinians are not allowed to leave Gaza, and nor are Palestinians out of Gaza allowed to go in. If there is the occasion of someone needing a life-saving operation that cannot be performed within Gaza, technically there's exceptions made that they can be taken outside of Gaza to either Israel or Cairo or America or someplace to have the operation performed. But there has been confirmed, unfortunately, many cases of their parents, if it's a child, or sometimes the person themselves, being required to collaborate with the IDF and the border police regarding whatever it is they want them to collaborate with as a condition of them going to seek treatment. Consequently, anybody who successfully gets through for emergency or life-saving surgery someplace is suspect by the people he lives with as having had to agree to collaborate.
And we know it doesn't go well for collaborators. I mean, in any society, and certainly not in Gaza.
And so they want people to rat on their neighbors, basically. They ask people who do you know that are members of Hamas or sympathize with Hamas.
Well, this is a nasty part of the story that I've never actually heard before.
There's a lot of nasty things we discovered that I had never heard.
Yeah, so I'm interested in both of your experiences. I know that Dennis, you got into Gaza. Helen, you didn't, but you did go to the occupied territories. So let's start with you, Dennis. You got in through Rafah. That took some time. But what did you do there?
Technically, we were under the invitation of UNRWA, the United Nations Relief Works Agency, which provides a safety net and employment and assistance to about 90% of Gazans in one way or another. It's their lifeline. So we visited many of their agencies. Most of them are social work and nursing and rehabilitation agencies. We visited many of the hospitals, the schools. We saw the destruction sites left over from the December, January Israeli offensive.
Still highly visible, the destruction sites?
Nothing has been repaired. The blockade prohibits any construction materials, and the attack itself destroyed all of Gaza's capacity to generate construction materials. It was quite deliberate, quite selective destruction. So everything looks as it did January 27th when the attack ended and supposedly a ceasefire was put in place, but there isn't a ceasefire in place. There are attacks on fishermen and farmers. That happened almost every day.
Attacks by whom? What do you mean?
If farmers tried to get to their farms within a now extended no-go zone by the Green Line, that is, it's within 300 meters of it, they are fired upon. If they're just trying to get to their crops, trying to harvest things, that was extended from arbitrarily from 100 meters. Fishermen, if they go beyond a 2-kilometer arbitrarily designated line by the Israeli Defense Force, are fired upon. And we saw the videos of both, of farmers and fishermen being fired upon, being hit with water cannon. They're just in these open boats and being unable to ply a living. No exports are allowed out. The blockade says that only essential medicine and food is allowed in, but that has excluded blood pressure medication, fluids for dialysis machines. It's a tremendous handicap to the hospitals in particular.
Now, the people you met there, what was their spirit like, their attitudes, what they feel like right now?
They gave us tremendous cheers when we got there, and they're determined not to give up. I mean, it's clear that what the policy of Israel is to crush their identification as a people, to reject any form of sovereignty that they may exercise over their own fate. They're not having it. They are determined to govern themselves, to provide for themselves. They are very highly literate people. They have literacy of 95 to 98%. 44% of the people between 18 and 24 attend university. If you leave them alone, they'll take off like mad in terms of their own economy. But they're not about to be left alone as far as the IDF is concerned.
Now, Helen, let's move to you for a minute. You, as I said, didn't get into Gaza because they blocked you. What did you then do? You stood there for 3 days. Was that camping out? What was it, a hotel?
No, we didn't camp out. We actually stayed a few miles away at an organic farm run by Israelis. I should say that our trip was run by Code Pink, but also the Israeli Women's Coalition for Peace. And so they set up a lot of the arrangements. Since we didn't think we were going to get in, we had other arrangements in case we didn't get in. I think the best words to describe Israel, and I had never been there before. I was in Gaza in March with another Code Pink delegation. So I really wanted to see Israel, and I got to do that for the first time. And the best way to describe it is there's always a catch-22, no matter what. So, for example, the Israeli government says, we let everything into Gaza. We don't allow anything. That you even see trucks going in and they drop the stuff after they've been through at a warehouse, and then the IDF returns the stuff.
No.
So it's the IDF who decides what gets in.
Wow.
And they can say to the government, we're not blockading everything. That's one example.
No. You know, or it rots in the warehouse.
They don't let people take it out
right.
of the warehouse?
Right. And you should know, so the stuff that they allow in is about one quarter of what had been allowed under normal conditions. So people's diet and people's needs are, just imagine if you had to reduce your food intake right now by 3/4. I mean, Dov Weinglass, who's a government official from Israel, said, we're going to put those people on a diet. So, these people had a fairly decent standard of living. They're not a third world country that we're used to seeing like Nicaragua. But now they are facing severe cutbacks because of the blockade and because of the vindictiveness of the IMF was, and Dennis didn't mention this, to bomb and kill all the animals, as many animals as they could. So there's no protein sources in the country. So little kids are having problems with their stunted growth. A few other catch-22s to give you an example in Israel is, so we visited a West Bank Palestinian settlement called Beilin. This is where, as you remember, an IMSer was hit by a canister of tear gas and was severely wounded, and I think he's still brain damaged. I don't know his status. But so they took their case to the Supreme Court. They won in the Israeli Supreme Court that the wall is built too far away from the Green Line and it should be moved. That was an Israeli Supreme Court decision 2 years ago. But again, you know, nothing was done about it, and it has not been moved. They have demonstrations every Friday with Israelis and Palestinians and foreigners coming that go up to this wall and protest it, and there's usually tear gas, and several people have been killed at these protests. We participated, and we were tear gassed at one of the protests. But I just want to say, so you can win in the Supreme Court, and again, it doesn't matter. Nothing happens. So that's a catch-22. It's the same thing all over. We met someone who was offered $1 million to give up his house, and he wouldn't do it. I mean, this is how tied to the land these people are. And for 37 years, he's been fighting this. He went to Turkey to get the deed to show that his family owned this land under the Ottoman Empire.
Wow.
You know, and again, oh, well, we need this for an anthropological theme park that we're building because we found artifacts from King David. So it really belongs to us.
Right.
Someone said it's like a smorgasbord of laws from Turkey to Israel to the IDF to the Supreme Court. And they just pick what suits them, whatever, you know. And then there's always the fallback, which is IDF security. It's stacked against you. The other thing that I really noticed there is the absence of Palestinians in a lot of the cities.
And where?
In Tel Aviv, for example. You know, there's
in Israel itself, you're speaking.
Yeah, and I'm talking about in Israel. I kind of thought, since I'd never been there, that the kind of Palestinians would have the lower-level jobs, kind of like Afro-Americans.
20% of the country or so, right?
20% of the country,
over a million Palestinians.
And you go to Tel Aviv, and what do you see? Thousands of foreign workers from the Philippines and from Vietnam, just so that they don't hire Palestinians. And it's very hard for a Palestinian to rent a house in Jerusalem, in many cities in Tel Aviv. It just is not done. And so, like, the people, you know, are disappearing from some of the cities or being forced out. They can't make a livelihood. They can't get jobs. In Jaffa, which is right down this 10-minute walk from Tel Aviv, which was a all-Palestinian city, you know, it's a very it was the entry of the Crusades. And by the way, they just found an Egyptian gate called the Ramses Gate. So if you keep digging under these different layers, you don't just find Jewish artifacts, but you find Egyptian, Hittites, Philistines. So this whole thing about what you find under the land is really...
You know, that's always been just as a side issue.
Right.
I studied archaeology as a kid, and I wanted to be an archaeologist. And as I became a very political lawyer, I used to say to myself, why didn't I be an archaeologist? Because it's not always so contentious and disputed, and you just dig. And then, of course, one of my nieces told me, Michael, you're just completely wrong. Everything is about which layer you're going to save. I mean, that's the whole thing. I mean, and it's, of course, it's completely right. And Israel, of course, is a classic example.
Jaffa now is being totally gentrified kind of into a Williamsburg, Brooklyn area for Israeli artists. They're moving into these beautiful, you know, tiny alleyways and setting up.
Yeah, I visited Jaffa as a kid. It was completely Palestinian.
Right.
Completely.
Well, it's being totally gentrified, and they're being moved out. And in fact, I went through it and I asked, because I wanted to buy some Palestinian art and stuff, which...
Helen is showing us a little Palestinian bag.
Which
here.
I didn't buy there because I asked the Israeli jeweler. I said, is there any Palestinian crafts or art? She said, oh, no, it's just for really well-known artists.
Nice.
Just Israelis. That was the answer I got.
So, Helen, I want to take you back to the occupied territories in a minute, but before that, I want to go back to Dennis for a second.
Yeah.
Dennis, give us some more of your impressions of, I mean, most people who listen to this have never been to Gaza. Right. Most of them probably haven't been to Israel as well, either one. Mm-hmm. Give us some more of the impressions of being of this trip to Gaza, which was extraordinary. I mean, how many people have really gone in the last year? Not that many.
Well, the Gazans want public attention more than they even want the supplies and the reconstruction material or money. Right now, money does no good because they can't buy anything. They can't do anything with it. But they feel isolated. They feel that they have no one on their side. But what they do have, certainly, is legality and morality. I mean, that's the least contentious issue in, I think, international law history, is the violations against them. So that's one thing. They want people to come there. They want American policymakers to just come there. Just look at the destruction. Just look at the suffering, and they'll know what was wrong and what was right. The other thing is just the cruel, almost medieval destruction inflicted by this fourth largest army in the world, these people who are armed at most with some Kalashnikovs and some military equivalents of bottle rockets. 1,400 people were killed in this conflict. It wasn't a conflict. It was a massacre. 6,000 people were injured, horrible injuries from white phosphorus. 450 children were killed. 120 women were killed. Hospitals were fired upon point blank. I toured one. They had a tank encampment 20 meters away, which just did target practice on this hospital, destroyed a whole new wing that was built with American dollars. The American School, it's called, was flattened. I mean, this is a huge three-story concrete reinforced building that looked like someone has stepped on it. It was destroyed. It was built with American money. The night watchman was killed. Fortunately, he didn't have his family with him. But the UN school, the UN Food Distribution Center, was totally wiped out. The Ministry of Health and Education was wiped out. That's where all the public records are of births, of medical records, of death records. The parliament buildings were destroyed. The court buildings were destroyed. Their governing body, the elected Hamas officials, meet in a tent right now. And we met with them as we met with some Fatah representatives. We met with everybody and we talked to them. Just the type of destruction that was inflicted upon them gives some idea of what the intention was, and that is to destroy them as a people.
What's the reason that's given for the blockade, embargo, whatever term is used by the Israelis? I mean, on what legal basis, but even more, what are they saying about it?
They no longer give reasons. They do not, for example, Judge Goldstone has been appointed by the UN Human Rights Commission to do an investigation of the charges of war crimes, international law crimes, etc. He's already been advised by the Israeli government they're not going to talk to him. They haven't talked to Amnesty International when they did their investigation.
Right. Judge Goldstone was formerly on the Constitutional Court of South Africa.
Correct.
He's an eminent jurist.
Absolutely. We met with him.
Right. I heard that the delegation met with him.
And he says, no, he says, they don't give a reason. They don't give a damn.
So, Helen, you didn't get in. You went to the occupied territories. How long were we in the occupied territories for?
Well, we were in and out. We were in East Jerusalem. We were in Tel Aviv. We took a trip up to Galilee. So we were basically our whole trip after 4 days at the border trying to get in. 6 more days was in Israel and the West Bank. I just wanted to back up a minute because since I was in Gaza to say something.
I forgot. You've been in Gaza.
Yeah,
early.
In March.
Yes.
I think the attempt of Israel is to break the social fabric of society. That is what they were trying to do. As even Hamas said in their meetings with us and with the second delegation, it's an attempt to even get people to get some of the younger people to drive them to despair and become what they would consider terrorists. They really targeted innocent civilians to break the morale of the people.
They really said this is really to drive people away from Hamas. They essentially said that.
Yes.
And of course, that's completely illegal. You can hit military targets, but you can't wipe out people for harming the morale of a community or a government or anything.
And I think it's important, maybe, Dennis, you want to tell after I speak a little bit on Israel about the letter that Code Pink got from Hamas.
Yeah, Code Pink delivered on behalf of the what is known as the Palestinian National Authority, Ministry of Foreign Affairs, to Excellency President Barack Obama, President of the United States. And I don't know if you want me to read it. It goes on for a while, but it calls upon him to visit Gaza or to send George Mitchell or a suitable representative to come to Gaza and to see what the conditions are there. It goes on to list the violations of international law and the Geneva Convention. It goes on to say what the findings are of various human rights organizations that have agreed that there are these colossal violations. And it says, and I thought the most touching thing, before becoming president, you were a distinguished professor of law. The U.S. government has also said it wants to foster the rule of law in the Arab Muslim world. The International Court of Justice stated in July 2004 that the whole of the West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem are occupied Palestinian territories designated for Palestinian self-determination, and that the Jewish settlements in the occupied Palestinian territories are illegal. And then it calls upon him to follow the rule of law and to accede to the decisions made on a 15-2 and I think 17-0 votes of the International Court of Justice. So anyhow, that's the letter that was delivered. Nobody came to Gaza.
Nobody came to Gaza.
Well, right. I mean, Jimmy Carter did come. Yeah, Jimmy and Carter. And I don't think he would have come without Obama's supporting it. And he did report back to Obama.
Yeah, someone told me this recently, and actually people were encouraged by this. Because after, you know, Carter's book and his very outspokenness about Palestine, and particularly on the human rights violations in occupied territories in Gaza, he's been apparently consulting with Obama on it, which I can't imagine that APIC isn't going, American-Israeli Public Affairs, isn't going completely crazy about that. So it was surprising.
Did either delegation bring back photographic evidence?
Oh, yes. Yeah, quite a bit of my wife, Barbara Grossman, went with me, I think. We brought back a lot of slides, which we're now, programming.
Well, so in the Galilee, we visited a lot of different places, previous Palestinian cities that in 1948 were burnt down and the residents were chased out of this, mainly where the Nakba, which is the catastrophe, took place. That's how the Palestinians see it. And we visited and talked to, you know, people who had been part of that, who had been run out of their towns, and their towns had been burnt down, their wells were poisoned. People should read this book called The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine by an Israeli, Ilan Pape, because this is really well documented. So some of these people who were chased out, and we talked to someone, for example, it happened when he was, you know, a young boy, and now he's an older person. But his family was split up, and half of them went to Lebanon, and half of them stayed in Israel. And they could never get together. If his mother or him went to try to visit his brother and his sister, and then they came back, they would be put in jail. So he's been invited to speak in Lebanon about the Nakba and has not been able to go. In a sense, Israel is becoming, you know, a closed prison. And this whole attempt, we were protested Netanyahu's speech. He spoke while we were there. And this whole attempt to make condition for negotiations, Palestine recognizing Israel as a Jewish state, is an attempt to further getting rid of the Palestinians that are still the 20% of the population that is still in Israel. And
I think that's actually a crucial point, because even the person they call the so-called moderate, what's her name, Livni, who is running for
Kadima, the Kadima Party.
She, a few weeks ago, said, well, the reason we favor a second state or Palestinian state is so that all the Palestinians living in Israel could be moved there. So they're talking about a Jewish state that's really ethnically cleansed of Palestinians.
The other thing that was very interesting to me is that the signs, the menus, the road signs were mainly Hebrew first, second Russian, because 10% of the population is Russian Jews, although a lot of them are not Jews. Third is English. And you hardly ever see Arabic.
That's amazing, with the 20%
that is
Arabic
really
amazing population.
So, and then in Haifa, we passed by, which is one of the few mixed cities that's still left. But you pass these empty buildings that Palestinians still own the deeds to, but they're not allowed to live in them. These amazing. Are still their houses, and they're just not allowed to live in them.
So, Helen, I know you're going to have a report back coming up, which is very exciting, at the Brecht Forum. Why don't you – I have a flyer in front of us, but why don't you tell our listeners about it, because I really think it's crucial to go there. Who's going to be there and what it's going to be about?
This is a report back from Gaza and a roundtable discussion. Many of us have already shown our slides, and this is kind of going to be more of a discussion, a roundtable discussion. What did you find most remarkable or outstanding or impressive about your trip to Gaza, and also a discussion about what we should continue to do about it. You know, should we continue these delegations? People have different plans. So it's more of a discussion, but there will be some film shown of interviews with people from Gaza. But the panelists are going to be Samer Abu Layla, who's an organizer of New York Community of Muslim Progressives, and he was on the Code Pink delegation. Medea Benjamin, the co-founder of Code Pink. Norman Finkelstein, a political scientist and author that many of you know, specializing in the Mideast, who was also on the delegation. Felice Gelman, who was a leader of the New York delegation and a member of Westpac. And Phil Weiss, who does the Mundo Weiss blog, which I would urge everyone to go to their website and receive it. It's a very good blog. And a video shown by Daniel Sturm, who's a member of Adala New York. It's Thursday, July 14th. Remember, Bastille Day at the Brecht Forum. For directions, call the Brecht Forum, 212-242-4201. It's on West Street near Bethune, near 11th Street. And it's co-sponsored by a lot of different organizations, so we're trying to make this a real discussion between the different organizations and where to go next. And
so again, July 14th, 6 to 8:30 in the evening, Brecht Forum. It should be fabulous.
I just think that this is a time when there's a crack in the wall, like it was during the Tet Offensive and the My Lai massacre in Vietnam, where all of a sudden people are beginning to listen. I mean, ordinary Americans are beginning to listen.
Well, thank you, Dennis and Helen.
Code Pink is going to be running more delegations in January. There's a delegation going on July 4th from New York. I'd urge everyone to go. And also, we're going to bring speakers from Israel who disagree with Israel's policies, some female draft resistors, a Palestinian delegate to the Knesset, and we're going to be touring them around the United States. So there's a lot of work to do. And as Dennis said, there's a real opportunity. We want to have these people speak in churches and synagogues and on the campuses because we think public opinion is beginning to change and we can help it along.
Well, I think it is as well, Ben. Thank you very much for going on that delegation and for coming into our studio. Thank you, Dennis.
Thank you.
And
thank
Helen.
You very much.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
Recently, the FBI, and particularly Director Robert Mueller, have come under fire for the practice of sending informants and others in to surveil mosques around the United States. We've known about this practice for a long time, really since the time of Ashcroft, shortly after 9/11, when they divided the whole country into sections and really told FBI agents, go mosque by mosque, get every one of them. Well, he came under fire. And then Mueller defended the practice of using informants to monitor mosques in the United States. Last month, a judge ordered the FBI to submit 100 documents detailing the Bureau's surveillance of Muslim leaders in California. This use of agent informants and provocateurs by the FBI is unfortunately the order of the day for our intelligence agencies. As a result, cases like the Liberty 7, the Fort Dix case, and the recent Memorial Day weekend alleged terror plot in upstate New York have been filed with great public hoopla, but with little, very little substance. Today we're joined by Shakil Saeed, Executive Director of the Islamic Shura Council of Southern California, to discuss
in particular, the FBI's continuous infiltration of mosques throughout the United States.
Shakil Saeed, Executive Director of the Islamic Shura Council, thank you for joining us on Law and Disorder.
Thank you for inviting me.
Recently, the FBI Director, Robert Mueller, commented and said, we don't investigate places, we investigate individuals with regard to the FBI spying of mosques. What can you say about that?
In fact, I responded to that on the record saying that either he doesn't know what's happening under his nose in his own department or he's lying.
What is happening?
What we know for fact in Southern California through ongoing surveillance of mosques, through the infiltration of provocateurs and predators in mosques, surveilling the sermons, surveilling the activities, attempts to recruit mosque members to keep an eye out on the clergy leader, the imams, and the mosque activities, approaching and intimidating and harassing students to recruit them to spy on the clergy leaders and the lay leaders of the mosques and reporting the activities. Folks coming back from travel, being stopped at the airport, again, asking the similar questions, which mosque do you go to, what activities takes place in the mosques, and so on and so forth. All of these combined contradict what Mueller says, that he does not, and their department does not, surveil institutions and organizations that are protected under the Constitution, but rather individuals.
Recently, the Council of Islamic Organizations sent a letter to Attorney General Eric Holder making similar complaints. Can you tell us what was the content of the letter and what was the letter requesting?
The letter insisted, essentially, A, on investigating all of these allegations that we are alleging that the FBI has been doing and is doing, and B, to create a system via which there is oversight and transparency in the activities that they undertake. Three, to share their guidelines, whatever that they are, that they claim that the constitutional rights rather than otherwise. And fourth is to go over the situation, particularly with Council of American Islamic Relations, that is not specified in any way to anyone anywhere in the country, with the exception that CARE is considered to be a suspect organization, while we all, as community members and community leaders, consider CARE to be part and parcel of the community, an integral part of the community that protects civil rights and civil liberties of Muslims and Arabs in this country.
What was the Attorney General's response to the letter?
Silence.
What, silence? Wow. This is Michael Ratner. It's really good to have you. You know, I recall, and I'm just thinking now about it, when Ashcroft was Attorney General, you know, shortly after 9/11, the FBI issued a set of guidelines, or at least not just guidelines, but also, we understood, an order that FBI agents in every district had an obligation every single month to go into and eventually visit every single mosque in some way or another and set up informants. And then, of course, there was a new set of FBI guidelines issued at the at the end of the Bush administration, which I think President Obama has allowed into effect, about using essentially ethnicity, race, religion, et cetera, to be able to spy on people. Is that part of this issue right now? I mean, this is all related, I presume.
It sure is. It sure is. I mean, you know, all we are baffled at this time is there's a great deal of surplus on the political rhetoric by the current administration, and there's a great deal of deficit at the policy level. This is just an ongoing and continuum of the Bush policies. We haven't seen any difference other than just a lot of rhetoric that this will be addressed, this will be changed. And in fact, you know, what disturbs me is Mueller's insistence when he said what he said in L.A. I didn't attend that particular press conference, but when the reporters called me to respond to the statements he made where he says that we are going to escalate the activities that we undertake through informants in mosques. And the administration is absolutely quiet on that. And that disturbs me quite a bit, that this is a tacit approval of the Bush policies and the culture that seems to be becoming rather ingrained and pervasive in the agency's culture.
Shakil, what's the right word for this? It's so outrageous. Is it racism? Is it stereotyping? What connection could possibly be made between, what, 15 out of the 19 people that blew up the World Trade Center were from Saudi Arabia, and now they're spying on mosques in California. It seems to me this is like a giant racist distraction.
Well, this is legal religious bigotry that unfortunately continues to happen.
You mentioned that there's no difference between what's happening now and what happened under the Bush administration. Was that because we have the same FBI director?
I think it's more than the director. I believe that there is a systemic problem with the Federal Bureau of Investigation. Individual agents whom I have had the painful privilege to talk to and interact with more in the past, I don't know, between 2001 and 2005, and since thereafter, I don't speak to them. But during those conversations, they used to share that this is grandly stupid. They are just keeping us busy and doing things that has nothing to do with actual intelligence gathering and counterintelligence, counterterrorism, and so on and so forth. And they used to admit that there is a systemic problem. All we are being told by the DC is to do this, to interview people, to harass people, to interrogate them, to stop them at the airports, to visit their mosques, to visit schools, and so on and so forth. So I think it certainly the leadership plays an important role in that continuum, but I think there's a systemic problem in the agency itself. They just need a perceived enemy to keep themselves busy and keep seeking resources. In a response to the recent Mueller statement, I responded by saying he's lying, in reference to that they're not surveilling the mosques and they're only surveilling the suspects or the individuals. And I said that that's a clear lie, either a lie or he doesn't know what his department is doing.
It seems to me that there's not a whole lot of difference between investigating the way they're doing it, investigating people and investigating places, because once you put an informant inside a building, once you tap a phone line, once you start marking down whose cars are in the parking lot, you're looking at everybody who comes onto that property or who's a part of that community.
Absolutely. I mean, all of that plus more, actually, by the admission of this provocateur. You know, I have stopped using the word informant, Dahlia, anymore. Reason being that these are not simply informing about activities. These people are provoking and entrapping innocent people.
That's right.
In places of worship. I shuffled between using the word provocateur and predator, really. What we do know from this particular provocateur who was implanted in Orange County in Southern California by the name Craig Montell.
Shaquille, some of our listeners may not have heard the earlier segment where you told this story. Can you summarize this story for everybody, please?
I mean, Craig Montell is a person who FBI paid anywhere between $2,500 to $10,000 per month for about 18 months to fish victims from mosques, according to his own statement in the court of law, between June of 2006 and October of 2007, if my memory serves right. And he was asked to prowl six different mosques in Orange County regularly, and he falsely pretended to become a Muslim and embraced Islam in mosque, befriended several Muslims, and then used provocative language. And when he was reported by one of the mosque members, then that mosque member was harassed by FBI, saying that your life will be a living hell. And then he was picked up on the allegation that he is part of Al-Qaeda's sleeping cell in Orange County, and so on and so forth. You know, Craig Montell is an ex-convict.
Typically.
And he has conned several women, hundreds of thousands of dollars. And by his own admission, the arrangement between FBI and this individual was that you do this for us, and we will expunge and, all the past.
So they picked someone who knew how to develop relationships and lie.
The extent of FBI's due diligence in finding people
extortionist.
Right. I mean, this. That's why I say that, you know, this is a systemic problem. And the same thing we see also, and I think you folks know more than I do, what was recently reported in New York as well and several other cases where it's serving as a provocateur and then entrapping innocent people.
The New York case is really, I mean, we covered it here, is extraordinary.
you know, the one that took place in Westchester, upstate New York. But what was interesting, yesterday there was a statement by local FBI people saying now that they're bringing some of the Guantanamo people here, or at least a few, to try, that all their resources are going to have to be spent on those prosecutions, and they won't have time to do the regular weeding out of terrorists among us. And I just thought to myself of this complete agent provocateur who was up here visiting the mosque and engaging these four young men in, you know, in BS crime. I mean, it was really shocking.
Suspect strongly, and I didn't have time to do enough research, but whenever these statements are made, they are followed by demand of resources from the government. If we were to investigate and link these two, these statements like Mueller's statements that, you know, we will do more, we need more resources, and that's the best place to gather information and so on and so forth, I translate that as, I don't have enough money, give me more money. And I think it's something that we ought to look into closely and see if American Muslim citizens are being used and manipulated for simply generating more resources while blackballing them and while doing illegal activities on them and demonizing and dehumanizing them through these statements and activities by the agency.
I want to say, this is, to me, just listening to you, it's just such a shocking interview, really. Yeah. The revelations is just so extraordinary, because I know that at the end of the day, that when the evidence comes out that every single mosque in the United States will have been visited by the FBI or have an informant provocateur
or a bug
sent in them, every single one, I have no doubt about it. And I put that onto, like, whether it's Jewish synagogues or Christian churches. And can you imagine the outrage if that occurred with a different religious population in this country? It's really a stigmatization that is going to be very hard, very difficult to overcome. And I think your earlier point of talking about the rhetoric of President Obama with the fact on the ground is quite important. And while it's systematic in the FBI, there is some, at this point, responsibility, I think, of the president to match actions with the rhetoric.
Well, he goes over to Egypt and he makes a speech appealing to Muslims around the world and comes back here. Ultimately, he's responsible for allowing this kind of religious bigotry to go on right here in our own country.
I think he can get away with it in part because people don't really understand what's happening on a smaller local level. In Michigan, what was really striking was a complaint was filed with the federal government. I think it might have been the FBI or the Attorney General's office, about the FBI trying to recruit local Muslims to spy for the FBI. Now, what's fascinating to me about that is the local FBI field office denied that they were doing this. But we know that it's happening all across the country in every state.
Shaquille, you get complaints like this all the time.
Almost on a daily basis. Yeah. As early, here is as fresh as Monday afternoon, I got a call from one of the community leader, Egyptian-American background. And he was called upon by this FBI agent for a meeting. Of course, we instruct as much as possible, and not everyone listens to us. But for the most part, we suggest that, you know, never ever meet with them without an attorney present, and we'll be happy to provide them an attorney. In any case, this individual calls, and I get his phone number, and I call this FBI agent, who I don't know. He's a rookie, I guess. And I called him on his behalf and said, what are you trying to meet this gentleman for? Of course, he was quite shocked and surprised to receive a call from me then from him. My conversation with him simply revealed he is simply revisiting the files that were left behind by his predecessor or whoever handed over those files to him. So he's simply reopening those files because the files exist on community leaders. And when a new guy takes charge of a particular area or section or a geographic jurisdiction, then they revisit all of that again. And I said, I'll be more than happy to meet with you. You need to come to my office and I'll have an attorney present. And 99.9% of the time, it never happens. They never call you back. And in cases where some community members who have pending immigration files, naturalization process, or conversion from H-1 visa to resident visa, and so on and so forth, those types of people are openly and clearly threatened sometimes and lured other times, that if you don't cooperate with us, if you don't work with us, we know that your status is such and such. If you cooperate, of course, this will be taken care. if you don't, then you probably would never become a citizen, would never get your green card, and so on and so forth.
I want to remind our listeners, we're speaking with Shakil Saeed, who's the executive director of the Islamic Shura Council of Southern California. Really extraordinary what you've been telling us. Is there a way for our listeners to reach you with a website?
Yes, it's Shura Council, shuracouncil.org.
You help people find attorneys to accompany them to FBI interviews. Can they go to that website if they've been contacted by the FBI?
Yes, indeed.
So one last question for me. You mentioned that you were speaking with the FBI from 2001 to 2005. Can you describe the context of those conversations and why you stopped speaking with them?
Yeah, it was sheer waste of time. That's why I stopped, and it was deeply insulting and demeaning and belittling of myself to sit on the same table while I was being surveilled myself. Those 3-4 years of investment of hundreds of hours really was rooted in the idea from our perspective that, you know, these folks really do carry a deep level of hatred, and this conversation and dialogue might help us demystify some of these myths and fallacies that they harbor about Muslims and Arabs and, you know, mosques. So there was this outreach effort, in fact, initiated by DOJ, almost all major cities, I believe, and several of the Muslim community leaders and organizational representatives were part of that dialogue. And it took me, frankly, you know, I have absolutely no background experience in dealing with law enforcement other than interacting with a policeman when I get traffic ticket. It took me a year to figure out what the heck am I doing in the FBI offices and what kind of conversations are taking place and where are we going with all this. The work that I do does involve a great deal of activity, interacting with public service agencies in the local area. And then we started observing that FBI is interviewing people outside, and we are getting reports. And when we go back with those reports to FBI asking what the heck is going on, answer is that it's an open investigation, we can't talk about it, and this is our mandate, this is our job, this is what we do. Subsequently thereafter, I start suspecting that I'm being tailgated. Phones, I suspected my home phone, particularly the phone that I'm talking from now, was tapped on.
What made you suspicious?
What made me suspicious? Well, in the course of conversations, crackling a few times, the phone automatically dialed the local police. Local police showed up at my house, and they said, "You guys called." And we all are sane adults in this house, so we know when we are calling and not calling. Several of these things happen. And then we filed the FOIA case, not just on me, but 11 of us from Southern California. And lo and behold, we now know for fact. And again, this is directly in contradiction to what Mueller says and FBI says, that they don't surveil mosques and clergy leaders and so on. Through the FOIA, I now discover that several of my sermons were recorded. My public speaking engagements were being surveilled. I spoke against Iraq, against NCR's program that's part of the FOIA. This is after we filed the lawsuit. First, they said there is no documentation on you, but when we filed the lawsuit, then I got about 800 some odd pages on me, of which 80%, 90% are all redacted.
It's a big file for a few years.
It sure
Shakil,
is.
I'll tell you that, because we do a lot of this work. That's not small.
And we are litigating that, trying to get that unredacted to learn where are the violations and illegal activities that FBI undertook, which obviously they're hiding under the guise of national security.
It's all very scary, but what I liked about what you've done is it really gave our listeners, I think, a learning process here of dealing with the FBI. And, you know, we went through this at the center in the 80s when they were massively surveilling anti-war activists around Central America. Of course, it wasn't the same as the religious bigotry, but the FBI tactics were exactly the same. Wide dragnet surveillance. And then as soon as we would call as an attorney, they would generally 95% or more back off, because we'd say, well, you can meet us, I'll be there with my client, and they would back off. But so many people, and I think the lesson you learned, so many people didn't call us and talk to the FBI without talking to us. And I guess the lesson that you're telling all of us is you have a phone number, you have a website. When the FBI calls you, call. But you also brought out the problem of the green card problem, and we had that same problem in the 80s with the leverage that they can try and get over you because of that.
They did the same thing to the Black Civil Rights Movement in the 60s. They did the same thing to the anti-war movement. This is their MO. Now they've translated it into their latest scapegoat. The Muslim community is extraordinary, what you've been able to share with us, Syed. Thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder.
My hope as a Muslim American is in people like yourselves who stand up for our rights and who empower us, helps us, not certainly in the government, including Obama's administration has so far miserably failed. Very lofty words and statements, but not supported and backed up by concrete policies and actions. So it's my hope that good American people will stand up in these challenging times when most contributive and productive citizens of this country are being marginalized and demonized on a daily basis by the very public agencies that are supported by the tax dollars.
Shakil Syed, Executive Director of the Islamic Shura Council of Southern California, thank you so much for joining us and for sharing what you know about all this.
My pleasure.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.